This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about something that you told an interviewer. You told an interviewer that you have to know sometimes that you have to get rid of a beautiful sentence if it doesn't fit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you've done a lot of writing. You have several books on Amazon. You've written some children's stories. What's that process like?
Painful. It's like getting rid of an arm or a leg. You know, if you love language and you write something that you think really expresses the thought, but the thought doesn't fit, it's an amputation. I think Maya Angelou said about writing, less is more. I think she said it more eloquently than I did, but the art of writing is saying a lot with as few words as possible. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, something that a young writer really should go for. You know, I read the biography of, now I'm not going to remember it, but the guy who did Lonesome Dove, McMurtry. And in his biography, you know, here's a guy who's won the Pulitzer and all of this stuff. And he said, I didn't feel like a writer until after my fifth book. Well, I'm only working on my fourth now, so I still have a book to go.
You still got a ways to go.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, Don, I have written three books, and I must tell you that in today's world, getting published is not difficult. Now, in many respects, that's a very good thing because it allows innovation to come in, whereas the commercial publishers tend to want the tried and true, you know. I mean,
right.
We cannot have enough wolves and Harry Potters and wizards and so forth. But on the other hand, it means a lot of junk gets into print. People who are not, who want to see their book in print before it deserves to be in print. The problem is then it's getting an audience. It's finding people who will take a chance on you if you're not on the New York Times bestseller list.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about that? Now, it used to be that if you went to a vanity press,
mm-hmm.
which is what they used to call self-publishing houses.
Right.
If you went to a vanity press, you didn't really have the same kind of credibility as if you went to a Random House or, you know, a Macmillan or something like
exactly.
that. But vanity presses now or self-publishing houses like iUniverse or Author House or those folks, they allow people to print their books. So
right.
Does that mean then that those books have less credibility because they are self-published? I mean, there are good self-published books out there.
One of the reasons I'm with a small press, and I've been told this by agents, is my books don't seem to fit into any genre. So what they want to do is sell books quickly in the main press. They don't want to have to develop a new audience for a new taste. I don't know what James Joyce would do today, you know, writing Ulysses or Proust. So in one sense, it does allow innovation. But there is a pecking order. Wherever there are people, there is a pecking order. And yes, the stigma is still there for self-published books.
Do you use or rely on social media to help develop the audience, or do you rely on people who have already read your books and they are the audience for your next book?
Well, of course, I'm desperately dependent on those who have read my previous books, hoping that they'll come back. But yeah, I have to do things like the KBOO interview here. Mm-hmm. I have to go out and market, because publishers, not even the big ones, really do that anymore, unless you're J.K. Rowling's or, you know, one of the really big guys.
Mm-hmm. So then, do you do it primarily for the pleasure, or do you do it because it supplements income, or do you do it because you have a story to tell, or is it all the above, one more than the other?
Let me disabuse anyone out there who thinks that writing a book is going to make the money. Even McMurtry said, I wouldn't have a dime before a book writer. He said, it's only when I started writing film scripts that I began to make money.
So what about all the people who think that writing the book is going to be their ticket to the great American dream?
Well, it's a world lottery. Some people do it. J.K. Rowling did it. But it really isn't realistic. You're going to spend more money promoting your book than you will ever make from sales. Writing is, you asked why I write, and I will give you the same answer that Jack Kerouac gave his agent, and that is, I write because I must.
You were talking about Dunkirk, and you had said that you can't say the word Dunkirk without tearing up.
Oh, gosh, yes. Dunkirk was when the British soldiers were stranded in France, and the Germans were advancing at their rear, and they were going to be slaughtered. Churchill got on the radio, and I'm going to tear up again. He got on the radio, and he said, our soldiers are stranded on France. I need every rowboat. I need every ship to go and pick them up. And the British responded. People went out in fishing boats, everything, and they brought their boys home. It represents for me the human spirit. You know, we never should give up. Like my writing, I won't give up on my dream, but sometimes we human beings can be magnificent, and we need to remember that. It is so easy every day to watch politics and to become cynical. But Hamlet said, what a piece of work is man. How infinite in his capacities for good or evil. But let us not forget, and Dunkirk always reminds me, that we have a tremendous capacity for good.
I'm glad I asked you that question.
Well, you made me cry. Shame on you.
I didn't mean to make you cry.
But it touches the core of what I think it means to be human.
So when you write, is that your intention to try to remind the reader that, you know, despite the things that we can take for granted about the failings of humanity, that humanity also has the capability to be much more than it thinks it can be?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But I'll tell you, Don, when I sit at the computer, I open up to whatever there is that's universal in human experiences. And I know that sounds a little woo-woo-woo, but you know, there are many, many scientists now, which is why I referred to Holt's book, that are coming to the same conclusion. Not talking about God, but there's no question that there may be some sort of platonic world out there that we can tap into, and goodness and the universals of being human are there. And so my books come to me sometimes so fast I can't keep up with it on the computer. And sometimes, no, some days it's a dog day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are you, as an author, sometimes trying to trick the reader into your world so you can get them to see something that they may not normally see?
Don, if I weren't trying to do that, I should never pick up a pen. That's what every writer should do. If you can't contribute a new thought to someone, the kindest thing that can be said is you're a beach read. I'm not a beach read. And I love beach reads, don't mind, and I'm not going to pan that. But no, I'm not. Trompe l'oeil is an exploration of how do we know that we're conscious, and what is consciousness? Now, I bet every listener out there has woken from a dream, maybe a frightening dream, and suddenly realized they were dreaming. Oh my gosh, I'm dreaming. Well, how do you know you're not dreaming now? Do you see?
Mm-hmm.
And we live in this world where we behave as if every moment were predictable, when in fact it's not. And we may not even be awake. And in fact, as again, one of the scientists has been saying, I think we just might be particles of a superhuman mind. We may not even be real. We may be dreams. And he's saying that scientifically.
It seems like, looking over your books and stories that you've written, it seems like your whole life you've been telling a story, whether you do storytelling to your students or to citizens, because you also worked in county government for a while.
Oh boy, there's a story.
And you've also worked with union workers, and mm-hmm. now you're telling stories through readers. Why are you so compelled to tell a story?
Well, I think telling a story is human. That's the essence of humans. All we are to each other are stories, because stories are our ways of making sense, more than our eyes and our senses. The story is what gives us a sense of place, and it's how we communicate. It's how we escape the isolation of our minds and tap into someone else's. So storytelling is the definition of being human.
If we are all sharing, you know, the common human experience, then why do we need to tell stories? If everything about being human is already inside all of us. I mean, do we need each other to sort of remind each other of those stories?
Well, you really raise an interesting question. I think the story is a kind of meditation of how we reach out and attempt to understand the world we're living in from our perspective. So in fact, Don, we're not talking truth. We're always talking perspective. The other way is, of course, the way the Buddhist goes, which is through meditation to achieve that universal, or the way a mathematician does, who achieves it through symbols. But the point is, we're always on a quest trying to understand who we are, where we fit into this world, and what the heck the world is. Mm-hmm. There is a point where mathematics, physics, philosophy, and art converge, because the only tool we have is the mind, and many philosophers and scientists really are reaching intuitively now. You know, science enumerates, it measures, it categorizes, it divides, but it doesn't ever give you the whole. And the way of reaching the whole, I personally feel, and there are others with greater minds who agree with me, is that the way to reach the whole really begins with intuition. But the trick is, how do you know your intuition is correct?
Right.
So you see, that's why art is so important, because we now communicate to one another. And how does your intuition fit with my intuition? And eventually, someday, we're going to have a whole world of intuition. Maybe it'll be on the same plane. A little crazy, I know, but you know, I'm not talking voodoo. I'm talking science,
right.
Advanced science.
Right. Well, I had visited your blog, and this conversation was going on, and it reminded me of the scene in Contact, where the Jodie Foster character, she's looking at the universe through this capsule that she's in, and she just continuously repeats, no words, no words, no words.
Exactly.
She says they should have sent a poet. And it also reminds me of carpet weavings from the Middle East and from India that when you examine them, they look a lot like fractals.
Mm-hmm.
And the scientists who study those kinds of physics and optics look at carpet weavings and think, this is identical to what we're seeing under electron microscopes.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, how did the mind come up with this?
Well, the latest theory among some scientists is, since we all are, everything is nothing but stardust. That there is in that stardust, animate or inanimate, some kind of consciousness. And so, yes, as we engage in this voyage of discovery, we're going to be eternally surprised. I'm just so sorry that many people have yet to take that journey, that, you know, they kind of just expect the world to be consistent. And actually, it is so fluid, as quantum physics tells us,
mm-hmm.
You know.
What kind of conversations do you have with your friends?
Weird ones. But, you know, it's very exciting. And so I try to reflect this ambiguity in my work. I want people to begin to think that, you know, the world just cannot be taken for granted. And what you know at this moment may be something you'll unknow a day later. It's a more exciting world.
But people can be lazy. And they look for shortcuts. I mean, you are asking people to look deeper, but sometimes people are busy, or people are afraid, or people are not able to think the deep questions because they're too busy trying to make sure their water bill gets paid, or that there's gas in their gas tank, or that, you know, they're raising their kid right. I mean, it's clear that everyone has the capacity.
Absolutely.
To be a higher self, but do they always have the time or the willingness?
Well, that's why I write. I sneak up on them. This last book, Trump Loy, I've had a lot of howls. Oh, that ending. But that's right. I sneak up on them. You know, it's like the mother who brings the medicine in cough syrup, you know. Right. Oh, honey, this is so sweet. That's why my books are difficult as genre for an agent to place, because they look like maybe something by Daphne du Maurier. But by the time you finish them, if I've done my job right, you're going to be scratching your head just a little.
On your blog,
which is booksbycarolinemiller.com, if anybody wants to join me.
On your blog, you had said that Steven Weinberg, tell me if you remember this now, on your blog you said Steven Weinberg's exploration of the unified, this is getting back to what we were talking about before, mm-hmm. his explanation of the unified field theory gave a pretty good try at explaining the human condition. He said, the effort to understand the universe is one of the very few things that raises human life above the level of farce, which seems to imply that mostly everything we do is farce. Why do you think that he did a good job of explaining ordinary life? I mean, as a writer, if we're not all exploring the stars, does that make us kind of pedestrian and boring to write about?
You mean, do I think ordinary life is boring?
If we're not seeking that higher self by writing about ordinary life, is it a waste of time to write about those of us who are living a pedestrian life where we're not asking the big questions?
No, absolutely not. I mean, Albert Camus' The Stranger is about a man who couldn't cry for his mother, and that is so profound. I don't think you have to live a big life. I think just every once in a while you need to tune out and say, what kind of a life am I leading? I mean, it doesn't have to be a quest for the universe, because we are all the universe. So I think it's fair to ask people to think, is this all there is? Is this what I want? All of us, I think, are always a little disappointed, and we must ask ourselves why. And that's the beginning of the quest. So the fellow sitting out on the street with a sandwich in his lunch sack, he's as beautiful as Albert Einstein, and he should think about his grandeur.
Tell me about the play you're writing. Is it called Woman on a Scarlet Beast?
Woman on the Scarlet Beast. It's from the Apocalypse of the Bible. Mm-hmm. You know, she's the woman of Bamelagh, the Scarlet
Whore. The harlot, yeah.
The harlot. Mm-hmm. And I've just about finished it. I'm playing with the last three words. Again, you know, when I think words are precious, they've got to be the last right ones.
Oh, my goodness, the last
I've got
three.
Several variations, and I keep moving them around until it says just what I want.
Right.
But this is a Woman on Scarlet Beats. It's a story, and I wrote a play, and I'm not a playwright, but I saw three women who were living together, a grandmother, a mother, and a daughter. And I saw how, and they're ordinary people living on welfare, Social Security. So you say, can anybody be grand? Yes. And I saw these three women tearing at each other. It was just horrible to see. But I understood why they were doing it. They wanted love from each other, but they didn't know how to get it. And then their own personalities and their hunger just came out clawing, like Medea, you know, who kills her children because Jason won't love her. And I had so much empathy for these women, and I can't see them as a novel. I can only see them as a stage play, because that's the way I saw them.
Right.
But now there's a simple issue of family, not something cosmic, through which each of them is seeking love, which is cosmic, and stumbling in the dark, trying to find it. Now, that's poetry to me. That's a story worth telling.
Right. It sounds beautiful. When do you think you'll be finished?
When I get those three words put together. You know, I can be a little bit like, I think it's Albert Camus' The Plague. There is an author at the beginning of the novel who is starting to write a novel, and he gets the first sentence down and then the first paragraph, and then it keeps re-editing the sentences and the paragraphs. And then at the end of this long book by Camus, the writer scratches it all out and starts over again. I don't remember much about the story of Camus, but I remember that writer because that is the pain of writing.
Right.
Looking for the right word.
It makes me think, can you be a good writer if you're not a voracious reader?
No, absolutely not. I could not make sense of my puny little life without the literature, without our history. I could not.
The collective human experience.
Absolutely. That would be like stumbling around, you know, Schrodinger's cat, a black cat in a black box. I mean, good Lord.
Did your work in government give you many insights into human nature that underpin any of your books?
Yes. And the first insight was about myself, and which is why I got out of politics.
Right. And just to sort of touch on that, you worked for Multnomah County, and you also...
I was the original counselor serving on the Metropolitan Service District, or what's called Metro now.
Okay.
I helped form that government.
Okay. How long ago was that?
Oh, honey, I'm not going to tell you that. No, a long time ago. I don't even think I could remember.
So that experience did help give you an initial insight, and you said that insight was about you.
Well, yes, because you see, the minute I chose to run for something, people stopped being my friends. They started being resources. Can she give money? Can she walk a precinct? Can he get me an interview with a newspaper? That is, and the minute I recognized that, immediately, that immediate shift in perspective, and it frightened me, but then that's the game of politics.
Right.
You know, you have to sell yourself. It's a very corrupting environment because, A, you have to have money. Every time you vote, you make enemies. So you try not to have too high a profile. You have to choose your enemies and choose your friends, and it's so artificial. And then you compete with one another because he or she might be running against me for some other position I might want. So it's just a completely self-absorbing world.
Is that why you got out of it?
Absolutely.
And how did your experience in politics inform your writing?
Well, because one of the things I have learned about life that I wish I could translate is, unless we get the ego out of the way, we can't see anything.
But a lot of people say that ego is important because ego protects you, it defends you, it makes you make sure that you draw boundaries that other people can't compromise you over.
Oh, that's right. Freud is saying, without the ego, you'd kill yourself. You know, you have to have some self-love. But you have to kind of train it to step aside
right.
a little bit.
And as a writer, I mean, you have to have a bit of an ego, too. I mean, you have to have a pretty thick skin, first of all, to endure the people who are going to reject what you have mm-hmm. to say, and to believe that what you have to say won't be rejected by a majority, by a greater number of people.
I don't equate thick skin to an ego. I mean, the ability to endure is one thing. What I mean by the ego is thinking that my view is so important, and also being aware that my vision is only one of an infinite number. You know, when I first got to school here, I went to Reed as an undergraduate, and the first essay they gave us was one by Oppenheimer about relativism. And he said something that I never forgot, and that is, There are 360 degrees points on a compass. You can take any one of them, and any one of them is a true course. The trick is to remember that the course you take isn't the right one.
Do you have a writing genre that you tend to favor over others? Because you've written about a lot of different kinds of things.
One of my problems is I don't want to get stuck in a genre at my age. And I'll tell you, I'm 76. At my age, I don't want to. This is my free time.
Right.
See,
right.
So I want to try all of these. But I tend to be more gothic, psychological. You know, I love the graveyards and the overtones of what death means. So death has a prominent place in much of what I write.
Is that because of your age, or is that because you have always been interested in that aspect of life in general?
I just don't think you can contemplate life without death. You know, there cannot be good without evil. I mean, this is how we shape our understanding of the world, is by these contrasts.
I mean, I absolutely agree with you. I guess what I was thinking was we exist in a world of binary relationships.
Mm-hmm.
Where there is this and then there is its opposite. Mm-hmm. And there is the self and there is the shadow self. And the only way that you can really have a true appreciation for any aspect of anything is to... I remember when I was in college and the professor asked us to talk about the golden mean.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you achieve the golden mean? And I had said the only way that someone can really appreciate the golden mean is to go as far to the extreme as they can, because then they'll know what's out there. I mean, to be told to accept the golden mean as the ideal way to live doesn't really seem very practical, because they are sort of living your reality, not theirs.
We could all of us change the world tomorrow in a heartbeat if all of us changed ourselves. And that is what each of us has to learn. What I've learned as a 76-year-old woman who every morning gets up and say, hey, I've got another one, you know, is how precious the moment is and not to waste it. Death is the scale on which you measure life. Without it, what's the measurement? Really, what I want to be formidable about is truly to share compassion with my fellow human beings. Mm-hmm. People use the word love a little bit too much, in my opinion. I wish I could say I loved everybody, but I can't. I don't. But I can feel compassion for everyone, because I can always know that the hunger for love and acceptance is in all of us. And if we don't get it, sometimes we do bad things. So I hope I will always be compassionate with my fellow man.
So then, Carolyn, if people want to learn more about you, how do they do it?
People can find me, as I say, it's so hard to remember, booksbycarolinemiller.com. And my blog is called Right Away, so the RITE, just push the button and they'll get to Right Away.
Well, Carolyn Miller, I really enjoyed this conversation with you. Thank you very much for coming in and talking
to me. Don, I've had so much fun. Thank you for letting me come.
I'm Don Merrill, and I've been talking with author and playwright Carolyn Miller. Thanks for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud media sponsor of Organicology, the Northwest's largest gathering of the organic food trade. Study the organic industry and shape the future of sustainable eating. February 7th through 9th at the Hilton, 921 Southwest 6th Avenue in Portland. Again, that's Organicology, February 7th through 9th. More information can be found at kboo.fm/organic2013.
This is Gareth from Music from the True Vine inviting you to Once in a Boo Moon, an evening of live music provided by KBOO DJs. My fellow Music from the True Vine hosts and I will be performing as the True Vine Ramblers and bringing you a great set of traditional bluegrass music. Other acts include Henry and Moggy doing some down-home ragtime and country, Don McLaren and his fiddlin' friends striking up some old-time fiddle tunes, and Noontime Jamboree host Retta Christie and her one-night stand band performing some swing. Once in a Boo Moon is on Saturday, February 23rd at St. David of Wales Episcopal Church from 7 to 10 p.m. Doors open at 6 p.m., so plan on arriving early, as ticket prices also include desserts with coffee or tea. There will also be a silent auction and raffle items to view. For full details, go to the KBOO website at kboo.fm and click on Once in a Boo Moon under Coming Events. All proceeds...
This is Black Book Talk, our February edition, and I'm Emma Jackson Ford, bookwoman, here with
Patricia Welch, the library lady,
and Obie Hill with Mirror Image Books.
February is Black History Month, and we have a wonderful author with us today, Kim Moreland, who wrote the book African Americans in Portland. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you.
Well, actually, it's African Americans of Portland, and it's chock full of pictures of early Portlanders and some recent contemporary Portlanders. Kim, I'm so glad you could make it to be with us, but I'm so glad you did this book.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad that you invited me to come on the show. I'm really excited to be here, and it was a fun project to work on.
Well, it's the 87th anniversary of Negro History Week by Carter G. Woodson. And so this is a perfect day to talk about your very, very interesting book.